Well, hello again, everybody, and welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
And we have a very special guest for you guys today. We sat down and had a very fun conversation with Christopher Logan, who he played Sanjay in Founder's Mutation, the season 10 episode of The Revival. It was a great chat, and we're excited for you guys to listen to it. But before we get to that, let's hear some tweets.
He's made outrageous public statements on an internet site.
That wasn't him. That was me. And they're not outrageous.
Okay, tweets of the week. These are mostly in response to our episode about the X-Files episode, Arcadia, which we hadn't discussed before, and which was the winning selection in an online poll of which monster of the week you guys wanted us to talk about next. And so we went for it and discussed every angle of Arcadia that we could manage. And you guys responded, as you do, with lots of interesting points of your own. From SKS, we had, I loved your views on Arcadia and was surprised by the differences to the script. Yeah, Annie had the script with her and read some bits from the script during our episode. If you haven't heard that, go back and listen to that because it is very interesting. SKS goes on to say, I agree with you that the believability of the Monster of the Week suffered because of its execution, but Mulder and Scully's banter and the tension between them makes me like the episode. Yeah, fair enough, SKS.
Yeah.
Kathy G says, great insights on this episode. I love the idea of it as a fluffy fanfic gone wrong. And oh, the possibilities if it had been set in late season 7. I agree with you both. I love Arcadia, but I don't love it. The MSR is slightly uncomfortable and the monster doesn't quite work. Yeah, that's kind of where we were coming from on that as well, Kathy. Now, Rachel says, so fun. Arcadia is not one of my favorite episodes, but I thought you dissected it perfectly. Fave line, Skinner wrote this fanfic. I think you said that, Annie.
I don't remember, but I know we were talking about how he's the one that like had the idea for them to go undercover. Yeah,
that's right.
And I think you might have said that, actually.
I might have. I mean, I was really running with the whole fanfic comparison. So I might have. I think between the two of us, we came up with that concept. There's a wonderful fanfic series. This is from Rachel again. There's a wonderful fanfic series by Syntax 6 that vignettes all of Mulder and Scully's birthdays. And she covers Scully's Arcadia birthday. So we should all check out that fic. So that would be an interesting tie-in there.
I hope, Rachel, if you can hear this, send us the links because we will we will retweet them.
Absolutely. From Sunday Lols. Hi, Sunday. I love Arcadia and purely for the line when Mulder yells to Scully, and Annie can probably do a way better version of this than I can. Woman, get back in here and make me a sandwich.
You did good.
I love that line so much. The monster was pants in this app, but Mulder's light and fluffy banter and Scully's vague annoyance is a win for me. I just have to make a little British to North American English translation on that because, you know, I like to think that I'm sort of more or less bilingual in both forms of English, living with a Scottish man. And he does confirm that Sunday's use of the word pants in this context, in the sense of the monster was pants, is sort of British vernacular for, you know, crap, garbage, shit, poorly executed.
I was going to ask, because I was like, wait, is this some sort of Twitter lingo that I'm not aware of?
it's a Britishism.
But thank you for
assuming
that.
I'm assuming that's where Sunday is from. Maybe it's perhaps also in use in other English language countries. So do let me know, Sunday, if you are speaking a different dialect of English. And FYI, the word pants in British English is referring to underwear. Just a little something something for our listeners today. Come for the X-Files, stay for the lessons about British and North American English. from Nicole, and this is Syzygy93 Nicole. We have lots of great Nicole listeners. Nicole says, loved it. I totally agree with the separation and quality between the actual plot and the Mulder-Scully interactions. Tulpas are cool, and I wish they had done more with it. But, shoulder shrug, the cut stuff from the script was interesting. Yeah, totally agree with that again. The tulpas was kind of underutilized, perhaps. It is a cool concept that they didn't really do, like, a whole heck of a lot with. But they tried. Shoulder shrug. That's, I think, the shoulder shrug emoji is very much how I feel about the Monster of the Week in Arcadia, actually.
It's
quite accurate. Quite apt. From Erica Deb, Erica says, Love this. I was recently tweeting back and forth about how I hate the episode Badla. Badla's from season 8. So much that even the great Scully moments can't make me like it. In the case of Arcadia, the cute, funny Mulder and Scully moments are so great, I completely forget all of the episode's faults. So that's an interesting comparison in Erica's reaction between Badla, which nothing can overcome, the trouble there, and the Arcadia, where the MSR does make up for the plot for Erica.
Yeah, I guess the only difference I would say is, like, I feel like Badla, like the actual plot of Badla, is like actively offensive, whereas this one is just kind of benign and stupid, you know. So it's much easier to ignore the crappy monster of the week in this case, I would think. But it is interesting how Erica says, like, I agree that sometimes all you really need is some great MSR and it could make up for a lot. So
Or great Scully moments, which, I mean, great Scully moments got me through season 8, and I'm a season 8 fan now, and it's almost entirely because of the great Scully moments. Goodness knows some of the plots were a tiny bit on the weak side. Some of them are really strong. And that's all I have to say about that issue. From Fox Love, great chat, love the MSR. I see a bit of tension, but seems more fun. Scully just being Scully. I get one son could have left over angst, but she was completely lovely with Mulder in Monday. I, for one, wish he peed in the OJ container, but cute if it was because of Scully he didn't. Now, Annie, you are what I consider to be one of the world's leading experts on the X-Files timeline. Mm-hmm. And timeline-wise, is it accurate that Monday is right in that time frame as well?
Oh, yeah. It goes One Sun, Aguamala, Monday, then Arcadia.
And so that time frame is like as it unfolds in terms of the episodes, as far as we know.
There's really no way to know in terms of where Monday and Aguamala actually fall. I don't have my timeline, my handy dandy timeline that myself and some other people have. I don't have it right in front of me. But I do know that Arcadia is their first X-File back. And, you know, it's clear that in Monday they are in the basement office, but it seems like they're just kind of getting started. Like they haven't really gone out on any, like they're just kind of having financial audit reports or like meetings with Skinner. And so it seems like it could be very quick after it. And also Monday, to be fair, it's the same day they're living over and over and over again. So it's easy to think that Mulder or that Scully is being completely, she is being completely normal, but I'm just saying that the length of time they were actually with real Scully and Mulder in that episode is actually very small.
Yeah, they actually don't have that much interaction. If this was, you know, one version of that reality, she would have had, like, you know, just a very brief interaction aside from like when he's bleeding to death in her arms, in which case you don't expect her to be like super snarky at that moment.
And you know what? People, it's not that like her take is incorrect. I mean, it's people can read it however they want to read it. I just read it as slightly awkward, slightly tension filled, and I just think the placement is very purposeful. And I just call it like I see it, Jen.
Absolutely, as do we all. And I think that it's possible because I like to sort of see all points of view as well. I think it's entirely possible in relationships that you feel okay with someone one day and then not okay with them the next.
Exactly.
For no particular reason for the intervening thing to have changed, but like there are lingering issues that some days bug you and some days don't. So there's always that option as well.
Yeah, I suppose all of that to say the fact that she's a little irritated with him in Aguamala, but they are not really together for very much of that episode. All of that to say is I don't take her normal behavior in Monday to be indicative of her not being angry with him the following day or the following week, or not angry, it's not the right word, but slightly annoyed, because like you said, you know, things change. It's the attitude is there. I see it. And so I just draw my own conclusions.
Yep, absolutely. As can we all. And that's one of the wonderful things about the X-Files is that we can just kind of look at what's happening and interpret the clues as we see fit, because goodness knows it is not spelled out for us. So clues is all we got to go on.
And look, I got to tell you, I don't blame Scully in the slightest, because we were never given an apology or Mulder addressing his behavior to her in One Son. I mean, we can assume that it happened. I would hope that it happened.
I hope so.
But we never saw it. So let's assume that it didn't happen. She has every right to be irritated with him.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I will die on that hill.
I mean, I'll be honest. I mean, Scully has every right to be irritated with Mulder on a regular basis for all kinds of reasons. Let's be honest about that. But I mean, you know, he's cute. So that's all good.
Yeah.
From Isadub. Isadub says, love to hear your insights. I don't have the same point of view about the plot. I like that there wasn't a cult, that the people in Arcadia are just normal people willing to be there. I have the point of view of a European that doesn't know these close communities existing in the U.S. The episode points out what excesses of these closed communities, people accepting bad stuff, just have to have the feel that they are safe amongst the people that resemble them. The way all of us could lose common sense in democracies and switch into a dictatorial mode easily. Very interesting insights there from Isadub, I think, in terms of the sort of cautionary tale we can take. If we set aside the sort of potentiality of it being kind of a cult-like setting, what if they are just kind of like regular people, and all it takes to sort of turn on your neighbors like that and to be okay with these kinds of sort of violent acts is just wanting things to be okay and just wanting things to be normal.
Yeah, I mean, and I agree with her to an extent. I don't believe I said that I think that it was a cult. I think that what I said was I think it would have been more interesting if they had leaned into that idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the plot would have been more meaningful, and I feel like those characters would have been more meaningful. Mm-hmm. But I also think that there seems to be some sort of vetting system for these people to live there. Like, I feel like they always have this meeting. It seems like they have this meeting amongst each other, and they're like, are they going to play ball? You think they're going to play ball? And so it strikes me as that they carefully select these people, which to me just, it screams kind of culty. Like, they're going to pick people that they think are going to, quote unquote, play ball. She's absolutely right. They don't actually make that clear in the episode, and I don't necessarily know if that's even the intent, but I think it would have been interesting if they had made that the intent. That's all I was meaning to say.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I agreed with you certainly at the time as well that I think if it had been more culty, that would have been more interesting to me. But I do like Isadub's sort of suggestion as well that they could have leaned in a different direction and leaned harder into that direction, I think, of sort of the concept of, you know, evil thriving when good people do nothing kind of thing.
Yeah.
That they could just be regular good people that are just kind of like keeping our mouths shut, staying out of it. And that would have been kind of, and again, I think they should have leaned harder into that if that was the message they wanted to convey, because that would have been interesting too.
I absolutely agree. And again, I think that adding more people in the community would have helped that as well, would have helped either of those theories or plot lines along. There just weren't enough people. At the end of the day, they should have had more neighbors.
Yeah, a lot of those issues would have been solved by having a broader scope of the people in the neighborhood.
Yep.
Meanwhile, for Monica Fafan, while we're all kind of shitting on Arcadia slightly, Monica Fafan says, I loved it. I enjoyed the slight undercurrent of annoyance and tension. I think it's cute. And to me, Scully walking around with her face mask on, so chill and relaxed, giving zero fucks around Mulder, is intimacy. Also, look at them. And she included a great gift from the episode. That's a really great point, though, about, like, you know, I'm just very chill in my sort of night face mask. And that is like a kind of intimacy, isn't it? That you just don't care. That's the way you are around your spouse, isn't it?
It is. And I mean, I think maybe a lot of people don't really want to see that for that because they want it to be like, oh, I'm secretly in love with him, so I need to look my best. But that would be so out of character, and that would be so random, because Scully, she's never really paid all that much attention to that sort of thing. Not to say because she doesn't always look gorgeous, but she doesn't seem to be interested or too concerned with that, which is actually what made her character so great, was one of the things that made her character so great. And I think that this is just kind of further evidence of that. And I like that. And it is intimacy. That's absolutely what it is.
It absolutely is. And it really does kind of emphasize the total comfort level that they have between each other at this stage in their relationship, which is very sweet to see. You know, as much as, you know, a little sexual tension would have been interesting in that episode, and we were talking about how there isn't a lot, it's also quite charming to see this complete lack of any tension between them when it comes to sort of like, hey, this is how I am. Zero fucks given. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm totally relaxed with you, which is great to watch as well.
It's very funny, and it's very charming, and it's just very them. Yeah,
it's very cute, and it all fits in with that whole sort of domestic fluff kind of, genre that I was really enjoying in the episode.
The writers just really, I think they really enjoyed leaning against that trope. And they did it completely purposefully. Like,
yeah, they did.
Yeah, they knew how many people they were pissing off with this. They knew what they were doing. And I just find that hilarious.
Yeah, I think I think that it's a very interesting sort of take that they had. And it was sort of like, you know, let's take the trope of, you know, the domestic fluff trope and the pretend married trope, turn it on its head, don't give the viewers what they're expecting necessarily. And of course, that's the X-Files. It always throws us a curveball, and it usually turns out to be something really interesting and delightful out of it. So we love that.
Yeah, we do.
And from Krista, Casey at the Bat. Krista, I just want to give a shout out to Krista because she ran 5K for the NSF Strong at Home event, and she was on Team Scully Coffee for NF. That's, of course, a major charity that Jillian supports and that a lot of folks have been running the 5K for. I think August 29th, I want to say, was the date that most people seem to do it on. Krista ran the 5K while listening to the X-Files Diaries podcast and wearing a Rain Knight mask, very nice, and that Nerd Sarah t-shirt. Those are two great artists in our X-Files community.
Oh, yeah.
And you can buy their stuff. I think that Nerd Sarah is also on Redbubble, I want to say. I know that Rain Knight is. Check out that tweet, and you can check out those Twitter handles for more information about their awesome X-Files products. And well done, Krista. Congratulations for being able to run 5K. I've mentioned previously, I would fall down after approximately 5 meters. So
yeah,
same. Congrats to you. And thanks for taking us along.
Yeah, glad we could be there with you.
It makes me feel like I'm an important and able person. So that is awesome.
It makes
so thanks
me
for
feel
that.
Like,
thanks for mentioning that.
It makes me feel like I got some exercise.
Yeah, I think that counts. I feel like I can feel the burn. So thanks for mentioning that, Krista. Thanks for boosting those great artists as well. We have wonderful, wonderful artists in the X-Files fan community, and we appreciate them too. And thanks, everyone, for tweeting with us and at us on our Twitter account, which is at XFD Podcast. We look forward to seeing you there. And now let's listen to this awesome interview that we had with Christopher Logan.
First of all, well, thanks for being with us. First of all,
yeah,
this
of
is
course.
Great to have you, and I'm
yeah.
we're both thrilled to be able to chat with you. I'm glad that this all worked out. So you obviously knew David Duchovny before. Did that have anything to do with you getting the X-Files gear, or was this completely unrelated?
No, it's sort of a little different. It's a bit of a different animal up in Vancouver. We're side players and smaller players sometimes up here. So the fact that we knew each other we sort of re-met on set. Mm-hmm. I got to talk a bit on set, but it wasn't something that came up in the process because we weren't part of each other's lives in the years between.
Right.
I mean, I think I met David on that episode of The X-Files. I was already dead in a pool of blood. I just stabbed myself in the head, and my hair was huge and long and covered in blood. So I couldn't move without like dragging blood everywhere. So I'm like this, and he like leans on me, straddles me, goes through my pockets, and then looks at me and goes, "Chris? Oh, how are you?"
So, oh my god, kind of, yeah. that is super funny. Well, you know, before we get ahead of ourselves, I do want to hear all about that, but I would love to hear how you, I mean, obviously you were already living up in Vancouver. How did this come to you, this role of Dr. Sanjay in Founders Mutation, we should say.
Oh, okay. You mean the audition process itself?
Yes.
Or how? Okay. Well, I was living in Vancouver at the time. I moved up from LA. I'd been auditioning for a bit. The X-Files role, I originally auditioned for something in the episode, I think it's the episode prior, to play a transgendered hooker who was attacked by a monster.
I
was familiar with the four lines in that script. He just came at me and I didn't know what to do and I was scared, but then I hit him, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Which,
I have auditioned for those parts as a transgendered person who was attacked by a monster, a hooker who was attacked by a priest, a hooker who was attacked by a cop, because it's a role.
Yeah.
But I didn't get that role because probably it had been at least 10 years since I'd done anything in drag and my makeup was horrendous.
I love it.
I did it on the lot at a friend's place close by. I just painted myself. And then you realize, oh, I really haven't done this in 10 years. How do you get the black out of, oh God, what's happening? And suddenly I looked like I'd been beaten, like just completely beaten.
Oh, man.
But then my hair was like here. But then they called me back from that for the role of Gupta, I can't remember the name right now. The gentleman who played my boyfriend in the episode.
Right. I think that was Gupta. That right? Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah. I actually came in and read for him. So I went from the transgendered hooker to the guy who tries to blow David Duchovny. and then I got called back for this role for Sonny Sanjay. And at the time, I think it was Dr. Sonny. But then we pointed out that that was a first name. So then we became Sonny Sanjay, which is two first names. So I don't know what that means.
I always wondered about that. I'm like, he's supposedly Dr. Sanjay, but everyone in the episode seems to call him Sanjay, and Sanjay is usually a first name. So I was always confused about that.
Yeah, there was some weirdness there. But the audition was really weird because it was actually about 2 or 2.5 pages with no dialogue. So it was
descriptives. You're just in pain.
Yeah, he runs in, he sees these birds, his eye starts to twitch, he hears this noise, it blocks him out, he starts to scream, no sound comes out, he starts to write, a pencil breaks, like that kind of thing. And I went into the audition fully thinking somebody was going to narrate this a little bit or something. But the director, James Wan, went, we chatted a little bit, and he said, okay, great, go. And I ran around like a chicken with my head cut off for probably what felt like 10 minutes, just screaming and crying and banging against the walls and grabbing a chair and all these things. And I have the ethnic boy curse of having died in a lot of films and TV shows. I'm just that guy. So I know how to die on camera.
Yeah.
So I know sometimes in an audition, they don't want to see you actually die. They want to see the moment before you die, because when you die, it's over. It's like putting a button on it. And in the audition process, it's like it's over. So they don't remember you because you finished the scene.
Right.
But if you stop in a good moment, they'll remember you.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So I talked about it with my friend who coaches me for this kind of stuff. And we talked about, well, you slam the thing into your head and then don't fall over. Just stay there. And so I'm screaming and running around like a maniac for 10 minutes and then boom. And no one says anything. And I'm on my knees and I look and I'm like, anybody? Anybody? Oh, well. And I just threw myself to the ground, and then everybody burst out laughing, which is great.
Right?
That's a better ending for the audition, anyway.
Yeah, that is, oh my God. That's really funny because Jen and I were just talking about it a little earlier, and I was thinking about the idea that you weren't interacting with like David and Jillian or any of the other actors besides the ones you were in the conference room scene until you're dead. And so a lot of that acting was the running around and you're just grabbing your head in pain. But let me tell you, this was the second episode of the season, but I actually think it was originally slated to be later, correct?
It was originally the fifth, I believe.
And
they moved it up.
That makes sense to me.
Which is good because I was actually an extra in the first episode.
Oh, were you really?
I was originally thinking there was enough space that it wasn't going to be causing an issue or something. But you don't really see me in the first episode. But I was doing extra work to fill in the gaps in between. So I was really nervous when they moved those things around because I thought
people might recognize you.
Really crazy. You know?
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to get back to that in a moment. But what I wanted to say is that, you know, and I swear I'm not just, you know, kissing your ass here, but like that scene was super, super, super effective because, and it's also for me, I have this really sort of, Jen and I have talked about this before. First of all, are you an X-Files fan? Like, did you used to watch the show?
Oh yeah. I used to watch the show religiously and absolutely loved it. And also as an actor really connected, because that's when it was just ending when I first started auditioning up here in 1994, 1995, something like that. So it was probably one of my first auditions was the X-Files after Breaker High. So it was like probably one of my first auditions. So getting that was like putting a button on the circle kind of thing.
Oh, well, that's kind of cool. That's kind of cool. Well, I was going to say there's an episode in season 6 that's called Drive that Bryan Cranston is in. I don't know if you're familiar with this episode, but it's kind of got, it's got a similar like auditory effect. Like he's being affected by this sound and these types of things, like it's like a personal trigger for me because I have like an ear issue. And so your scenes, all of this to say, your scenes especially affected me because I'm watching them and I am like really feeling your pain
And so all of that to say, well done. I think you did great, like, suffering auditorily acting.
I'll take the one that the well done, and I'm glad that you felt something, but I'm sorry that it was pain.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think when we're watching The X-Files, that's kind of comes with the territory.
Yeah, it's par for the course. It's the expected menu.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. To be expected. Yeah, I was thinking the same thing last night when I was rewatching the episode that I was watching. And I was like, I forgot how, like, horrifying this all was, but it really wasn't. It really was down to your performance. Like, it was very much, you could kind of feel the pain and feel the suffering. And it was like, I'll say it was cool, because I thought it was just cool.
Yeah. It's always lovely shows like The X-Files or a meaty part like that, that is bigger than life and you can go crazy with it, because a lot of character actor stuff up here, you tend to be always like, can you bring it down a notch? You know, you don't want to, you're not overshadowing the lead. You have to be a little quieter. So every audition is hey, you do your bit, and they're like, yeah, that's great, but can you bring it down a bit?
Right.
So this time you got to go, wow.
Yeah.
So
I feel like when you're the star of the cold open, you get to do that, because you are...
I want a t-shirt that says I'm the star of the cold open.
Yeah. Well, you were.
Oh, my God.
It is your responsibility.
So I never make it past page 6.
I love it. You didn't quite. But you know what? Very few stars of cold opens on The X-Files make it past page 6. So let's look at it that way. But you're
very
responsible for drawing everybody in. And you did that. And I think that's fantastic. I wanted to ask you about the experience of working with James Wong. I know you gave us a little bit.
Yeah.
But do you have any stories or any interesting tidbits?
I remember he came up to me on set once right before I was doing the scene where I was about to die. And we had a talk about methodology and what he was doing. He was just finishing a feature and chatting about what it's like working with other actors. And he said it's important to stay in the moment and things. And he also then handed me, he was talking about death and death on film and what it means in real life. And everyone has different beliefs. And then he handed me a coin and put it in my hand and gripped it. And I went, oh, okay, is this like because I'm going to die to like pay the ferryman like at the River Styx and stuff like that? He said, no, it's, you give someone a coin so that they don't actually die and they come back and give it back to you.
Oh, wow.
Which I thought was an interesting little thing. I was a little confused for a bit, but it makes sense. It's less morbid his way.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Well, and
I think it was something, because he's done a lot of action films and a lot of films with stunts and things, and I think it's something that some of the stunt guys used to do. They'd hand somebody something that they have to give back as a reason not to actually injure yourself.
Okay, right. Well, and that actually leads into my next curiosity, a question. What were you sticking in your head? Like, what exactly
thing,
is going
it?
On? And please try not to trigger me, please.
Do you want me to say first or say, like, I never thought of this at all till way, way after. My friend Kurt Nikolai is a filmmaker and an editor, and he's brilliant, but he's a very linear thinker. And he's like, I love the episode, but why in this sealed computer room was there a letter opener?
That's a good question.
I never really thought of that.
And until that moment, I had no idea. I had we choreographed knocking the pencils thing over and all this stuff, and it's spilling the right way and all that stuff. And it's a little retractable thing.
Yeah.
But it's really sort of a letter opener. And it would like break into your head that way.
Right.
Sorry, I don't know if that way makes sense. A collapsible.
Yeah. I know what you mean. It kind of pushes closed. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was until he had mentioned it, which I think was probably a year afterwards or something. I think he saw my demo or something. He was like, yeah, what was with the letter opener in the sealed computer lab that no one could get into? Why was there even paper in there?
Yeah. Like,
there's a printer, right?
There's
a printer.
If you think about it, it didn't make any sense. But I don't think the amount of people that came out to me about the episode between when it first came out and him is at least a year of nobody really noticed that.
No.
Or did you notice that? Is that why you mentioned it?
I didn't notice it at all until you just brought it up. It was not a thing that bothered me, and now it will bother me forever. So
yeah, completely.
A few. I mean, X-Files fans online, we pick apart every little detail, as I'm sure you know, and that has never come up to my knowledge. So I think you kind of got away with that.
It's
there.
It's bizarre, isn't it?
I think
it is bizarre.
Now,
I would think that would come up.
Now
maybe
it had a little ball, a little gold ball on the end of it, which I think was supposed to protect you. But I was getting into it; I just kept jamming it into my ear.
Oh, ouch.
Yeah, no, that's
supposed to put it in the side and just go boom, and it would just slide, and I'd be like, ah. But you'd go for it a little bit. more when you're dying, you know.
Right. So wait, but so it was a collapsible trick thing or whatever, but like, were you actually sticking it in your ear and then just letting it kind of collapse? Like,
yeah, it was a couple times it went in my ear, but I don't think it was necessarily supposed to.
Right. You were kind of trying to get it because I don't think you actually see it. Yeah, the temple. Okay. God, that seriously, that is making me itch right now. Like the idea of sticking things in your ears.
I can see you shaking.
Yeah.
It's quite a scene, that's for sure.
It's really good. I actually think that's like a really good episode.
It's brilliant. Yeah.
So, and we, another thing Jen and I were talking about was all of your dead acting. So how much?
And it's important.
You were pretty good in Dead, but also you gave us a really cool like Scully autopsy scene. I've heard people complaining before about how Scully did no science in the revival, and I thought that was not correct because she got a really cool autopsy scene with you, even though that looked like a dummy in part of it. I don't know if that was all a dummy or if it was
It wasn't all a dummy, but I got to say the dummy really creeped me out. I got cast for it. So they covered me in liquid goo and put stuff up your nose so you can breathe. And you're in this place in the creature factory in Vancouver where this guy does all the creatures for most of the stuff up here. And as you're going under, they're slowly, you're getting stiffer and stiffer and you're slowly going under and your eyes are the last to go. And you look up and you're like, oh, that's that creature from the... and you go under while you're staring at all these creatures on the wall around you.
Yeah.
And then you can't move for like 3 minutes while it's setting around you. And you're just sort of freaking out, which is just bizarre. But then on the set, on the day, I'm in the makeup chair and sandwiches come out because that's the best time of an actor's life. Uh-huh. 3 hours after lunch, the sandwiches. And we love
it.
I
can imagine.
So I'm eating a sandwich and... beside me is the dummy and the makeup artist. There's like 3 makeup artists doing stuff and they have like a little palette and a little patch of swatches for the skin tones. And they're like, do you mind? And they come over to me and start checking things if the skin tone's right or not. And they're like, what if his nipples is darker? And okay, there's a spot on the back of his neck. Oh, you know, one of his chest hairs here is really long. Should we trim it on him or should we add it over here? And I'm like, what in the world is going on? And I couldn't look at the dummy. I would look in the makeup mirror at the dummy because I couldn't make eye contact with it. So I'm eating this sandwich with cold cuts and salami and probably too much mayo or something. And as I bite it, they popped the head open and all the brains spilled out. And I was just oh my God, I nearly threw up. It was the most weird thing in the world because I just was not expecting it.
Yeah.
They were just testing how the brains would come. checking what color your nipples are. And
I'm trying to imagine what that must look like. Like you already probably don't think it looks like you because it's just probably weird, but it looks enough like you to be disconcerting that it's when they're cracking the head open.
Absolute perfect word. It's absolutely disconcerting. And I've been other cat parts of my body cast and stuff like that because I've died a lot in different things. I had my head cast before, but like I've died probably 12 times in 5 years or something.
Wow.
But like, it's just a thing.
That's impressive.
It's a skill set. I don't know.
Well, you're great at dying, Chris.
Incredibly disconcerting. That's exactly the right word.
Yeah.
But there was a moment in that scene with a really cool, interesting thing that happened with Gillian Anderson when we met, because we sort of did the first part of the scene and stuff like that. And we're just sort of figuring out how to set things up or how she's going to pull the thing out of my head when I'm dead on the slab and stuff. And we basically, the first thing you said is, oh, you can stick it in my hair. Oh, you don't mind? Oh, good. Thank you. Little tiny things like that. Right. And then we go sit beside each other and she's texting. I think she was texting someone in her son or something. And so we're in robes and I'm pretty much naked because I think James had mentioned during the shot we did panning down the body in the beginning. He's like, do you mind? We can see your shorts in this. Do you mind pulling them down a bit? So I stood up and pulled my shorts down. And that's when Gillian walked in. Oh. And I was like, oh, God.
Perfect timing.
Oh, great. And then I just hop up on there underneath and just hope she didn't see it. And then the next thing out of my mouth is, yeah, you can put that in my hair. Put that bloody knife in my hair. Then we're sitting beside each other in our little chairs. And this girl comes over who's working on the show, who I had met drinking the day I got the part. Like the day I got the part, I was talking to the X-Files at the bar. And I met this girl who works in the X-Files and we got massively drunk together and had a blast. And it was so great and all this stuff. And she comes over and she goes, oh, my God. Oh, my God. I didn't really know that this was you in the part and stuff until I was carrying the dummy you across the set and I and the towel that they put on its face for dignity fell off and I screamed because I recognized you and threw it. So they kicked me off the set. And then she's talking to me and then Jillian goes, you guys know each other? And I'm like, oh my God, I'm sorry, Jillian. This we met after the audition drinking. This is Piper. Piper, this is Jillian. And Jillian's like, oh, this is my daughter.
Oh my God.
And it was just like the weirdest thing. And then you go do the scene where she's pulling the knife out of my head after they lit it. And they're pulling it out. And Jillian goes, wait, you'll never guess. And she starts telling the whole story to the crew about the entire thing while we're lying there dead and naked again. So it's just, you can't make this stuff up.
This is a journey, just, man.
Yeah.
I love it.
But the film industry is brilliant at like completely making you believe in the glory and handing you your butt at the same time.
Oh my God.
You know, in exactly the same moment.
That's amazing. Huh? So you're telling me that you introduced Jillian's daughter to her? Is that what you're telling me?
I did, yeah.
So she's the one that you hung out with because she did a lot of the artwork for the revival. Am I correct? Like she did some of the designs and she worked on the show. That's really kind of random, yeah, but also.
But it's so funny. It's such a specific name, Piper. It's not like Chris or Jen, no offense, but like there's a lot of us.
Yeah, right? Yeah,
there are.
You know, or Andy. There's a lot of us, but there's not a lot of Pipers. And. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe there's more after Orange is the New Black, but...
right, probably.
Yeah. But it didn't clue in at all that that was her daughter until they said that. And then afterwards, I'm seriously flashing back on the announcement of her birth by Mary Hart on Entertainment Tonight. Or like something about that.
Oh, and you're my God.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Sometimes some actor boys were like a little too in the moment.
Yeah.
That is amazing that she, okay, I love that story that she's carrying your dummy and she freaks out because she remembers. Oh my God. I also wanted to comment too on the idea that they're talking about how long your hairs are, like as if anyone watching would notice.
I absolutely love that everyone's so precise because they don't know what is a close-up of that, but they're shading the nipples of being more purple or more brown and they're like doing the hair. It's lovely that they pay that so much attention, but man, is it ever uncomfortable or very strange to be talked about in that way when you're there.
Yeah.
No matter how comfortable you are, it's just a little...
They must have done an amazing job because I can't tell looking at the scene when it's really you and when it's the dummy, so obviously they're hard working off.
I was gonna ask because it's
me
obviously
all the time. Yeah. I'm so good at just being still and zen and
yeah, I would have believed it.
I was going to say that I was going to ask you because I could tell the only time I could tell it was a dummy was when they did the close-up of her actually pulling it out, and I remember thinking I really hope that's a dummy because I am cringing over here. But like, I could kind of tell it looked a little like, I mean, obviously the character is dead, so it looked a little pasty, but I was just kind of like, no, the face looks a little waxy. It was just not quite right. But you're saying that some of the other parts of the scene, like that was actually you lying there, obviously. They were kind of having you there.
I believe when she's pulling the knife out of my head, that little moment and stuff like that, and then she does a little speech and cleans her hands and things. But I think the rest of it, when they actually open the head, is actually all the dummy.
Oh my God. Well, I hope that. I hope so.
Yeah. And I'm always curious, like, is there like a special skill set about like not looking like you're breathing? Like, I'm always curious about this.
Oh my God, I'm horrible at it. When David was going through my pockets and I'm on the ground, my eyes are closed and I don't know where the camera is. So you start to almost panic breathe a little bit and you're like, oh my God, what's happening? I remember it's like, don't worry, you're good.
Yeah.
Because you kind of, you're there for a little while, but then you don't know how long the scene's going or what's happening. And they're resetting or they didn't call cut and they're going again, but you don't have your eyes open, but no one's focusing on you at that moment. So you don't know. So no one's telling you, you can breathe now.
Yeah.
And you have to figure it out. But it's one of the things with all this stuff is in film, you figured it. The moment you figure it out is the last moment you'll ever have to do it.
Yeah.
You figure it out and then they're on to the next scene.
Ugh. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then you never have to do it. You can learn how to juggle perfectly in a scene. You do three takes and on the third take, you get it perfect. Great. Never have to do it again.
Yeah. that's when they got it.
But then you have a skill set that you could have if you wanted to have it.
Yes. Yeah. Juggling and dying in the cold open.
Pretending to be dead. Yeah. Well, you know. I was wondering the same thing, because I'm always looking. I'm one of those people for sure, like Jen probably, who's like always watching movies and looking for like a vein to be throbbing or like a chest to be moving. And I didn't see any, for the record.
I always think that that's happening and stuff. I remember I died in an episode of Poltergeist: The Legacy like years ago. I always have the weird deaths. I was mauled by a donkey that was spooked by the ghost of the Good Samaritan. And then I died. But then there's this whole scene around the body, and it's raining, and I'm supposed to have my eyes open because I was scared to death, and I just kept blinking, and it was just so it's so bizarre. But you know, it's just the death thing. No matter how often you do it, it's just a weird thing to be lying around dead while things are happening.
Yeah.
And you do that panic breathing, or you figure it out. You're either worried too much or not enough. You either stop breathing and start to panic that you're not breathing, or you start to overbreathe and hyperventilate. It's very weird.
Yeah, that's what gets me. Just watching it sometimes, I feel like I'm going to have like secondhand panic breathing just watching it, because I'm like, it's one of those things, the more you think about it, the more complicated and hard it gets.
Yeah. I'd love to be one of those people that doesn't like phones it in or doesn't care, because they probably can just lie there and be fine.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if I'm doing enough or not doing enough, or just in the moment figuring out what's happening, and I just probably overthink it.
Yeah. Well, it looks good to me. I think you made a very fine corpse.
On shore right now, you know. I can't think of the actual name. I got a Twitter mention that they have my corpse on tour with the X-Files.
Oh, with the X-Files convention, the dummy, you mean? That obviously.
The corpse is on tour, and the outfit's on tour. Although I actually think it's the wrong outfit. But
I'm always seeing the funniest, most awesome stuff. I think that's the Preservation Collection, right? It's like, it's called the X-Files Preservation Collection. They have like the coolest looking stuff. So they have it. How do they get hold of all this stuff?
Oh, I have no idea, but they were raising money. They were doing a GoFundMe or a Kickstarter, I'm not sure which. Mm-hmm. And every time they popped another thing up, I'm like, how did you get this stuff? Aren't you getting this all from the same person?
You would think,
why are you
right?
Sourcing all this stuff from different places. Wouldn't you just call the X-Files group and get everything from them? It seems bizarre to me.
Well, I think they somehow did. I mean, I know that they met their goal, so that museum is getting made, which I think somewhere in New York, I think it is, which is really cool. When this whole COVID thing is over, we're all going to have to make a trip.
To see your body.
Can I mention something odd? In the opening, there's Scully going through the pages in the opening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, yeah.
And that's actually my friend Lisa Peterson's hand.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she works in costume. She's absolutely lovely, but that's her hand. And sorry, she just would get a kick out of me saying that.
That's very cool. We love to hear that stuff.
I have a question that might annoy you, but please indulge me.
Oh, go for it. Please go for it. Oh, my God.
A lot of fans are curious about the sort of vibe on the set, like particularly between David and Jillian. Did you notice anything interesting or noteworthy or funny, or was it very much like in and out professional?
I was pretty much the time I saw them together on set that time, I was dead and they were around me and stuff like that. They were friendly and they were nice to each other and they get along and they have a history and they know each other. And
yeah,
I didn't notice anything that they were secretly having an affair or that they hate each other or anything like that.
Yeah. Come on. We want all the dirt from you, Chris. We're supposed to know everything. Oh.
I can give you dirt on David Duchovny from Connie and Carla, but no.
We love any stories that you have about that. Like even working with them, when you worked with David on Connie and Carla, how was that?
He was very jovial. He jokes a lot on set, and he's just always quick-witted and clever and just having fun. Like I think like all actors think we are. We're like 6-year-old kids playing a lot of the time.
Yeah.
There's a lot of the intellectual part of it too. But he's very much present and just having fun in between takes and comfortable and relaxed and fun to be around.
Yeah, I feel like I get that vibe from most people that he just seems like very professional but always just like a kind of fun guy to be around. That's really cool. And that's kind of like, that's really random. Not random, but like obviously you were an X-Files fan, but that you worked with him on this other unrelated movie and then later ended up on the X-Files, which you originally auditioned for back in the day. Like, that's really cool to me.
Oh, there's always weird things. I remember auditioning for Red Shoe Diaries back in L.A. ages ago and stuff like that. Or is it up here? I can't remember which was where. But so that we crossed paths there before. Like, it just keeps going. Some people you're just always running into again and again. This is
weaving
only a
in and out of your lives.
Him, but, yeah.
That's really cool. So you You mentioned earlier that you were an extra in the first episode of the season.
Yeah, there's some. Now forgive me, it's been a while since I've revisited. The guest star female is being interviewed by a bunch of reporters, and my hand is one of the reporters.
Oh.
That's really
nice.
You never
I
know
think
until,
you're referring to Sveta.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. I can't think of the actress's name, but
we will go find that hand.
We're gonna
find
it.
Put it on
our
Twitter feed.
We're gonna send you a screenshot, and you're gonna be like, "That's my hand."
And it's really your hand, not the dummy's hand.
Yeah.
It is true, actually, because the dummy will have been effectively colored for better skin tone consistency or something.
So I think we want to talk about some of your other work. We just want to give you a chance to talk about some of it.
Oh, well, I'm working on a really cool project at the moment because I'm producing a film. My producing partner, Kiri Geen and Ken Shapkin and me, we got a grant from the Canada Council for $100,000, and we're doing a fairy tale based on Kiri's life. Kiri is a Tlingit Indigenous powwow dancer and artist, and she was adopted by a white family when she was younger and rediscovered her culture by studying and embracing the art of her people. And we worked on a lot of sets together, standing in, background, acting, all sorts of stuff. And she would tell me these really interesting stories of connection and how she figured out who she was and figured out how this stroke of line in art meant that she was from this place and how it meant something to her before she knew it was supposed to, and little moments of connection that I thought was really interesting. So I ended up putting those all together and writing a fairy tale that we're going to be filming actually in September. And our director is actually Grace Dove, who was one of the female lead in The Revenant.
Nice.
Yeah, so it's such an interesting group of people coming together. We have the production designer from Magicians and Tomorrowland and Man of Steel working with us, Margot Reddy. And our lead actor is, now if you're sci-fi fans, you'll know Tam O'Pennicott.
Oh, from Battlestar Galactica?
He was Hilo on Battlestar Galactica. Mm. And he was the lead in Joss Whedon's The Dollhouse.
Yeah.
So we wrote a story of Kiri at 6 years old with the white father and the indigenous mother who passes away, and how the family deals with the grief and how they guide themselves through it to be able to find out how to fully embrace both sides of who they are. Mm. And Tamil will be playing the dad.
Oh, that's
nice.
Really cool.
That sounds very cool.
It's quite a lovely story with heart, and just is everyone's coming to the table for the right reason. And I'm very, very hopeful and excited about it.
That sounds great. Yeah. What's the name of that feature going to be, Chris?
It's called Kiri and the Dead Girl.
Nice. Okay. It sounds amazing. I'm going to look out for it. I'm in Canada, so they're always happy to let us see Canadian films whenever possible up here. So I will definitely keep an eye open for that one.
Cool. I can send you guys a link to our site. We're Moon Children Films is our website. And we're also doing a GoFundMe thing, too. I can send you that link as well.
Please.
Absolutely. Yeah, it sounds like it.
I would appreciate that very much.
Yeah,
it sounds like a great story, and the kind of story that we maybe don't see enough of on film. So I would love to see that succeed in wonderful ways.
Now, have you guys talked to anyone else from that episode of The X-Files?
I don't think we have. No, not yet. Okay. You're the first.
Oh, cool. I feel privileged.
Yeah. We are privileged.
Do you have an entire Rolodex you're going to offer us? Was that going to be your next?
Well, it's Vancouver. We all sort of know each other by one degree of separation, or have been on multiple shows together. There's Nikolai, and I always get his last name incorrect, but he was playing an evil character on Sabrina for years. There is Omari Newton, who just is in The Shipment with Alex Ponovic, that's doing well, which is a short film that's just premiering on Amazon Prime, I think. Allison Wanzura, who is in every single thing that films in Vancouver. She's that person who books a lot. And she's a brilliant actress, and she's a chameleon, and she's just great. But they're the three people in the conference room talking while my hearing is going in and out.
All right. Cool.
Yeah.
And so are the people you met on the set, or people you already knew?
I knew two of them before in little ways, and then met Omari officially on set, but we knew of each other and stuff
right.
like that.
Yeah. Nice. I guess the Vancouver acting community is a pretty tight one by the sounds of things.
Yeah, we're a smaller group than Hollywood, shall we say. Mm-hmm. But in Vancouver, it's sort of like you're generally the actor and your friends are a dry cleaner, or a restaurant owner,
right.
or a chef. Like everyone else does something different. Whereas in LA, I think there's a whole bunch of actors who know each other.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, Chris, about, I was looking on your It was on your Amazon, actually. And this children's novel that's called Daphne, the Penguin Who Wanted to Fly. This is a book. I want to hear about this book.
I actually absolutely adore this book. It is my heart. One of my best friends years ago, Jamie James, was going through a thing where he was having trouble learning how to trust himself. You know, like he was stuck in the rules. He's a dancer, and he was basically working in office jobs because he was 26, and he was trying to, like, he kept being told he couldn't dance anymore. And instead of transforming that into something, he was going into the real world as an office worker, and he was kind of getting depressed and getting sad about it. So we used to have this joke that we had a daughter named Daphne who wanted to teach lesbians how to fly. The original joke was that, and then she had four brothers and sisters, Daphne, this one, that one, and the other one over there, and they all gave their college money to Daphne because she's the first one in their colony to go to college, and she studied aeronautical engineering because she wanted to teach lesbians how to fly, and yellow because who doesn't love yellow?
Right.
And so we'd have this story that we told for a couple of years, like a rolling gag that just kept going. And for Jamie's birthday one year, I wrote it into a 145-page novel for kids as a way of showing him, one, how to complete a project, and two, everything we've ever discussed about what we want to do is in that book.
Mm.
So it's a lovely story. It's actually taught in a school in Vancouver at Vindy Elementary School, Sir Alexander McKenzie, with a teacher named Jen Young, who's very lovely.
Nice.
And it is, it's pretty much the story of, you can achieve anything if you believe it. It's how to let the impossible into your life by not knowing there's rules that you're supposed to not break. So it's a penguin who doesn't believe she can't fly, and her best friend is a polar bear who doesn't know she's not white.
Oh,
I love it. It seems like a really amazing book. And from what I've seen, I'm going to have to get it and read it, I think. And from what I've seen of anyone that's mentioned it online, just loves it. So I definitely want to read, because it sounds like it's quite unique in terms of the style of the writing and the whole sort of feel of the book. So I think it sounds really, really cool, which is always a good thing in children's literature to have like a variety of voices.
Yeah.
Just look up Christopher Logan on Amazon. And you have three books there, if I'm not mistaken, Chris.
Yeah, well, there's a book actually the Daphne the Penguin Who Wanted to Fly is available through lulu.com.
Okay.
That's something I self-published. But I did a series of coffee table books years ago after Connie and Carla. Every drag queen in the world knew who I was. And I didn't realize that. I was a drag queen for several years, way before that, like 10 years earlier.
Okay.
And I decided to put a book together of the top drag queens around the world, a giant coffee table book. And I was calling people and saying, would you like to be in this book? And everybody was calling back and emailing saying, I'd love to be in the book. By the way, I loved you in that movie. And being in Vancouver, you're going, oh, I wonder what movie they mean. Because we don't think about it. Because you're in so many small bit parts and so many things. You're like, oh, okay. It never dawned on me that everyone had seen Connie and Carla at that point. You know, it just didn't occur to me. But it's all the top drag queens in the world, all the top drag artists in the world, from the old school stuff like Coco Peru, who's a brilliant comedian, and Lady Bunny, who started Wigstock, and the people who really held down the fort, to people who was like a main makeup artist on America's Next Top Model, Sutan Amriel, as Raja, and then a lot of people from RuPaul's Drag Race. But it's a book I'm super proud of, and is absolutely lovely. And then we did a sequel with the top stars of burlesque. For the International Burlesque Hall of Fame, which was sort of a limited edition print.
Nice. Really, it's such an interesting and sort of broad range of subjects that that you sort of invest your passions in, which sounds really interesting.
Yeah, I have ADD.
We can all channel it well.
Yeah. Yeah, original thing was that drag book was originally, it was supposed to be our Kickstarter to fund a drag movie I'd written.
Oh.
And it was what started me into writing films. And that's sort of more what I've been working on the last little while, which led to the grant and is leading to this film that we're making, Kiri and the Dead Girl, in the fall.
That's cool.
So they all tie together, even though they're all different animals.
Yeah, but one leads to another. And if it's something you're excited about, then that will show in the work. And it sounds like you definitely are, which is great.
It's nice to see you're keeping busy.
I'm like a puppy who can't hide his passion. I'm just always like...
It's all good.
And in the COVID days, I'm feeling a little guilty that as an artist, I'm sort of thriving because I sit down and I'm writing on my computer and I'm working on scripts and prepping films for next year and doing all that and not getting interrupted by having to go to work. So it's kind of interesting that way. It's a weird time to be doing well, but it kind of works that way because the artists are usually not doing well normally.
Yeah, that's.
I just had a meeting in my apartment with five people: our cinematographer, our Sterling Bancroft for *Carrying the Dead Girl*, our Grace Dove, our director, Ken Shapkin, Kiri Gein, who the story's about, and myself, who are all producing. And we're in a small room, and there's construction going right outside the door all day, because of course there would be loud construction going on.
Yeah,
so we have the door closed, and it's a super hot day. So everybody's wearing masks, and we're all sweating through our clothing. And like every now and then, someone's like, "Do you have any more water?" We're doing that. But we have to keep the door closed the balcony closed because of the noise.
Sound, yeah.
But everyone's still keeping their masks on because
it's the right thing to do.
Is worth somebody else's safety.
Yeah. I have a couple questions to ask you before we wrap up here. Because you said you were an X-Files fan previously, we just have a few quick fire questions for you.
Oh, God. Okay. I'll do my best not to think.
They're not hard, I promise. Okay. If you could name your favorite episode.
Oh, I don't know by the names, but the cockroach episode.
Oh yeah.
Yes. War of the Coprophages.
Yeah.
That's a Darren Morgan episode. Yes.
Oh, it was a gorgeous episode. Set the tone for the comedies. It was just every time it got funnier and funnier and funnier. And it was always just slightly unexpected that they were still going there. Yeah. It was lovely.
That's a good pick. Love
Great
it.
Great choice. Yeah.
Next question is Mulder or Scully?
I have to go Mulder just because I've worked on two films with him.
Well, and I didn't say David or Jillian. I said Mulder or Scully.
I have a feeling that Scully would care less whether or not I pick her.
And that's a really good answer. Because you're right.
That's fair.
Love it. Monster of the Week or Mythology?
Oh, I think they work hand in hand very well.
Mm.
It's hard to pick. I think they created a balance where the Monster of the Week gave you a break from the mythology so that you could rest and trust the mythology when you got those moments. I think it worked well together.
That's a perfect answer. Yes. No, that's a great answer. Love it. And last but not least, and be sure you answer this one correctly, Chris. Mm. Are Mulder and Scully platonic partners or soulmates?
I don't know if soulmates or... I don't think romantic involvement. I believe they're the ones who have each other's back in spite of themselves.
Okay.
So if soulmates can be the friend that you are always trusting, who will always be there for you, even if they don't agree with what you're doing, then I'd go soulmates.
Okay. I think that's also a good answer.
I like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I know I'm playing the middle there a little the last two, but.
Oh, hey, you made a fine argument in both cases.
Yeah. We're both like biting our tongues, but it's okay. No,
it's okay. It's all good. All opinions are valid.
Well, Chris, this was super fun.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I had a great time, and thank you. I thought I was a little nervous because I haven't done a podcast yet, so it was interesting. You're my first.
I'm so glad you broke your you broke your cherry, popped your cherry with us. Thank you.
Yeah, we feel honored, and you didn't seem nervous at all. You were an absolute joy to have on, so thank you very much for that.
Thank you both very much. Thank you, Jen. Thank you, Annie.
Please tweet at us at XFD Podcast, and we will be back with you guys on the next episode of X-Files Diaries.
Bye!
Mm-hmm.